this meeting to order. According to our clock, it is 8:05. We have present Representative Smalley, Representative Hudson, Representative Coghill, and myself, Chair James, and in comes Representative Kurtula. So we do have a quorum. First item on the agenda is HJR 9. The bill sponsor is Representative Cross. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for hearing HJR 9, I think it addresses a very important public policy issue, but I know you have some other very important public policy issues to reach today, so I'll try and be brief, and we have three presenters who I understand will be brief as well. HJR 9 addresses the retention of records under the Brady Bill. The Brady Bill was, as I'm sure all of you recall, a very difficult issue and a very difficult compromise. One of the elements that was key from the perspective of gun owners and certainly from the perspective of the National Rifle Association was that none of the records that were generated by the Brady Bill concerning lawful gun owners be retained by the government. That has been for a long time a very grave issue for them. There was no controversy over keeping records on people who are found to be illegally attempting to acquire firearms. We've all agreed that that's where the focus should be, on keeping guns out of the hands of people who should not have them under law. And that compromise, that clear directive, was, I think, clearly stated in statute. The Brady Bill concerning the instant check says that if receipt of a firearm would not violate the sections of the bill, the system shall, not may, destroy all records of the system with respect to the call, other than the identifying number and the date the number was assigned, and all records of the system relating to the person or transfer. I think that's pretty clear statutory language. So it was with some surprise that I learned, and others learned, of the regulations enacted pursuant to that statute, which allowed the FBI and other government agencies to keep records on lawful gun owners for originally up to 18 months and now under the final regulations for up to 6 months for what they called audit purposes. It was disturbing enough to me that I drafted this resolution, which simply asked that not take place. I believe it's contrary to the clear language of the statute. The statute doesn't say immediately destroy, but I think keeping something for 6 months just ain't destroying it. It's something else. It's more like keeping it, really. And I don't think you had to have that immediately before to know the intent of this statute. So the resolution asks that that the government stop keeping these records on lawful gun owners, continue to do whatever is necessary on illegal gun owners or persons who are trying to acquire guns illegally, and further ask that if it's necessary, though I don't believe it is, but if Congress finds it necessary, to clarify that language, put in the word immediately, or whatever else. That basically concludes my testimony, and I thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions for the conference? Hearing none, then we could go to Dell Conference in Fairbanks. We have Mr. Dick Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and this is Dick Bishop of Fairbanks. I'm Vice President of the Alaska Outdoor Council and part-time lobbyist for the council, on whose behalf I'm testifying, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. The Alaska Outdoor Council is vitally interested in the safe and ethical exercise of the individual right to keep and bear arms, and we strongly support HJR 9. We thank Representative Croft for introducing the measure and his co-sponsors for their strong bipartisan support. This is an issue that knows no party lines. Regulations mandating retention of data on lawful firearms purchases under the so-called Brady Bill's instant check provisions are a cynical subversion of the clear meaning of that law. The law's provision mandating destruction of those records does not mean some Tuesday next week or 6 months later. The purpose of the instant check is to determine if a firearms purchase is legal. Once that determination is made, there is no rationale under the law for retaining that record. purpose of the law has been fulfilled when attempted illegal purchases are forestalled. As anyone who has worked in or with government knows, it's all too easy for bureaucracies to overlook or ignore statutory requirements and regulations. The six-month destruction deadline easily becomes no deadline through neglect or for an ulterior motive. Or it might be revised in a future regulation if there's no objection to the initial one, to 1 year or 5 years or permanent retention. There's not much good to be said about the Brady Bill, in my opinion, but at least it was agreed that it was not to be the first step in an all-out gun registration system in the nation. We applaud the National Rifle Association's legal challenge to this foot-in-the-door regulation. I wonder who decided there should be a six-month data retention. It appears to fit right in with President Clinton's patronizing political campaign to demonize all gun owners. The Alaska Outdoor Council urges the legislature to promptly pass HJR 9. We also recommend that you transmit the resolution to every state legislature and every governor, in addition to the distribution outlined in the resolution. Thank you very much for your efforts, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Dick. Do you have written testimony? Could you provide it for LIO there?
Yes, ma'am. I'll have to get it translated into readable English first, but I can certainly do that.
We sure appreciate it. Thank you very much. Now we could go online for Brian Judy.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Brian Judy. I am speaking on behalf of HJR 9 today, on behalf of the 18,000-plus NRA members who live in Alaska. And like Mr. Bishop indicated, I also want to express appreciation on behalf of those members to Representative Croft and Representative James and all the other House members and senators who have signed on to this bill in an effort to help try to influence Congress and the President to do away with the National Instant Check System record-keeping, which has been unfairly and inappropriately imposed by the FBI. I just want to provide a little background. In 1993, the NRA worked very closely with Congress in drafting the law which created the National Instant Check System in an effort to ensure the privacy of firearms owners. And one of the provisions which was of paramount importance to the NRA was the one requiring destruction of records. It's Section 922 of Title 18. And this law requires that the instant check system, and I quote now, shall destroy all records of the system with respect to the call and all records of the system relating to the person or the transfer, unquote. There are two small things that are allowed to be maintained. That is the identifying number of the transaction and the transaction date. And the whole point of keeping that unique identification number and the date was so they would have an audit log. The legislative intent was clear that immediate destruction of the personal information pertaining to the prospective purchaser would be destroyed. And this is Hello?
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
We can still hear you.
This was further evidenced by another section of the law, which went on to specify, and again I'm going to quote, that no department, agency, officer, or employee of the United States may require that any record or portion thereof generated by the system established under this section be recorded at or transferred to a facility owned, managed, or controlled by the United States. Nor could they use the system established under this section to establish any system for the registration of firearms, firearms owners, or firearms transactions or dispositions except with respect to a person prohibited from receiving a firearm, again, unquote. Now, clearly, the only information which can be maintained by these systems other than those unique identification numbers and the transaction dates is information on the bad guys, information on people who are prohibited from possessing firearms and who are illegally attempting to acquire firearms through the system. History has shown over and over again how firearms registration systems have led to firearms confiscation mandates. law-abiding firearm owners clearly understand that the creation of a gun registration system is a major step toward the destruction of the Second Amendment. The NRA urges you to support HJR 9, sending a strong message to Washington, D.C., that federal bureaucrats are not and should not act above the law, and that the integrity of the Second Amendment must be preserved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Do you have your testimony in written form?
Well, again, it's not formally written out, but I can do that no problem and submit it.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your testimony. Here in Juneau, we have Del Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Del Smith, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety, State of Alaska. Sponsor asked me this morning to stop by to discuss what went on when the State of Alaska and local law enforcement authorities did Brady checks up until November 30th of this year. Since the Brady law went into effect, with the exception of a couple county sheriffs in Lower 48, local law enforcement and state law enforcement, chief law enforcement officers were responsible to do Brady checks until a court decision by the Supreme Court in 1997. It has been my understanding and all of law enforcement administrators that I've talked to in the state of Alaska that when we ran a Brady check on somebody, there was not a problem with that transaction. We did got rid of all of the attendant paperwork, names, etc., that went along with that transaction. Prior to taking this job in 1994, I did conduct some audits for the Department of Public Safety on NCIC compliance and absent compliance. And in the agencies that I checked, there certainly was no records relative to Brady. When I had questioned the transaction, they said that's a Brady check. Now, to the extent that there's not any way to confirm that was a legitimate check in Brady, that is somewhat of a downside. But the state of Alaska and local law enforcement has always understood that we destroyed it immediately. We did not keep any that I am aware of in this state at all. That concludes what I have to say as a way of testimony. I'd certainly answer any questions.
Representative Olgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maureen Dale. You said except for a few sheriffs that didn't capitulate to this program, everybody's been checking. Those sheriffs were the ones that sued, were one standing, and ultimately won the case to repeal.
Yes, I believe it was a Montana sheriff and an Arizona sheriff that refused to do it and went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that local law enforcement was not obligated to do the checks.
I thought it was an interesting case because it, Madam Chair, if I may follow up.
Go ahead.
Because it set a precedent for someone besides an attorney general to litigate to the U.S. Supreme Court, which might be relevant to Alaska. One other question.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Wilkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has the Department of Public Safety pursued any of the, say, convicted felons that have attempted to buy firearms with charges for violating their violating the law because they can't own firearms?
Through the chair, I'm not familiar with any individual cases. That certainly would be our instructions from the management level to do that. Certainly since the NICS went into effect, we've been informed of a couple of individuals that attempted to buy firearms, and my instructions to the detachment commander were to, if there are applicable state charges, in fact, the person got the weapon, and if there are applicable state charges, to pursue those. But I did not follow up the individual cases, no, sir.
On that point, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Mr.
Is it not illegal for them to attempt to buy a weapon and have troopers been dispatched when there's attempts?
They're not authorized to purchase a weapon. I don't know the charges would be filed if they walked in and attempted to do so. I suspect they could be, but, and again, I'm not aware of a trooper being dispatched to any particular location. Because of the NICS check, there's 3 days to respond back, and they might not get the refusal right then and just tell the individual to wait. So, and I'm not aware of the Anchorage Police Department or any other local offices being dispatched at this point. I'm not saying it hasn't occurred. I'm just not aware of it.
Real quick.
One follow-up.
Could you please let me know, get back with me? I would appreciate it very much if you'd let me know if that's illegal for them to attempt to buy a weapon, whether or not there's been any follow-up on those illegal attempts.
To the chair, Representative Olgan. Yes, sir, I will.
Thank you.
Representative
Hudson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Del, what would you do with the records of someone who illegally attempted to, unlawfully attempted to? Would you maintain those records? And
Certainly, there might be some potential for the criminal prosecution as we just discussed, and you'd need that transaction to support your police report and any potential prosecution relative to that. I think that certainly was my understanding of the intent to maintain those, and certainly not legitimate gun purchasers to be not maintained, but we would need that information to pursue any kind of prosecution should it be possible.
Follow up from the records, then. Have you had a number of those in Alaska in the last year?
Through the chair, there have been refusals, Representative Hudson. I'm sorry, I don't have the total number. I certainly could provide it to you over the course of this entire probably 5 years, because we do keep Brady statistics and factor on the homepage of the Alaska Department of Public Safety.
So the law is, through the chair, the law is apparently working to keep firearms out of the hands of some of the unlawful recipients, huh?
To Chair Representative Hudson, it certainly has denied purchase to a number of individuals in Alaska. I venture to say is, 50, 100, or potentially more. But to be specific, I'd have to check our statistics. But yes, it has prevented people from buying weapons that were prohibited by law from doing so.
Thank you. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else here in Juneau that wanted to testify? Anyone on teleconference that wanted to testify? Hearing none, then we'll close the public testimony. And,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hudson.
Madam Chair, I move House Joint Resolution Number 9 with zero fiscal note out of this committee with individual recommendations, and I'd ask unanimous consent.
Okay, the motion before us is to move HJR 9 out of this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. Is there an objection? Hearing none, then the bill is moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Before we go to, I've got some little housekeeping to do here. We had HB 45 and HR 7. That was Representative Williams' bill on constitutional amendment on changing the way initiatives are drafted. And I'd like to put that into a subcommittee. I will serve on the subcommittee, and I appoint Bill Hudson and Representative Smalley on that subcommittee, and if possible, we could meet Friday afternoon to discuss that. You both agree to serve on that subcommittee?
Also.
Okay. All right, fine. Then House Bill 77, do I have that copy here? Actually, it is a Military and Veterans Affairs bill, which sets up a statutory long-term interim committee between the House and Senate, task force and military issues, including the ballistic missile and BRAC decisions and so forth. This bill has been heard in the Military Veterans and Affairs. I had some concern because it didn't have a fiscal note for the per diem on the public members. But other than that, there was no dissent, just a very forward bill. And the Finance Committee can take care of the fiscal note if it needs one. And I'd like to waive the bill on to Finance, if I might. I just want to see if there's any objection to waiving that bill to Finance. Hearing none, then I will, on the floor, I will then waive that with no objections. Okay, now we're going to hear from We have a package of bills that are intended to be a suggestion as a funding mechanism for our budget deficit. And here we have Commissioner Condon from the the Department of Revenue, and he's going to present these bills. Let me tell you, before we start, we're going to present these bills as a package. And we will be taking testimony after, and we can have questions of Mr. Condon, and we'll be taking testimony. And before anyone testifies, I want them to say specifically which bill they're testifying on. So for those people on the teleconference, if there's those folks out there listening to my voice at this time. In the meantime, other than that, we'll walk our way through this and make our rules as we go. So, Commissioner Condon, come forward and tell us about this package.
I might just set up a screen and an overhead projector. It would be different things to do here, but figure out a way to do it. So if I might just beg your indulgence for a moment.
We could have we could have a little at ease while you're doing that. And we'll hear from Commissioner Condon.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wilson Condon. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue, and I'm here to testify this morning with respect to House Bills 89, 90, and 91, which together represent the governor's package pertaining to the state's current fiscal situation and his proposals on how we ought to move forward and address the situation that we're faced with. As you're all aware, there are, it's not clear to all Alaskans that we have a problem. And so before we talk about how we solve a problem, we need to talk about whether we really have one, and if we have one, what is it, and how do we get there? So let's go back in time a little bit and talk about a time when we were not as dependent as we are today on revenue derived from the oil and gas industry in our state. And you really need to go back to 1975, 2 years before North Slope production began, and look at the state's revenue portfolio at that time, and then compare it to the portfolio that was applicable during the most recently completed fiscal year, 1998. And as you can see on the graphic that I put up there on the screen, back in fiscal year 1975, in terms of the revenue that came in that year, $330 million, just a little over a quarter of it was from the oil industry. We, of course, had an oil and gas, well, we had a corporate income tax then, as we do now. We had a number of sales and use taxes, principally pertaining to tobacco, alcohol. We had some other natural resource taxes. We had earnings on the money that was invested in our treasury, and we had an individual income tax that provided just a little over a quarter of the state's revenue at that time. And if we fast forward almost 25 years and look at our revenue portfolio for the most recently completed fiscal year, you can see that we were became much, much more dependent on oil revenue. We still have the corporate income tax. We still have some sales and use taxes, other natural resource taxes. But missing from that picture completely is the individual income tax, which, as you know, we repealed in 1980. So that's the picture of where we were and where we are. And the important point to note there is our dependence on revenue derived from the oil and gas industry. Now, there's I can give you a little different picture of that here. And this depicts
our revenue proportion, oil and non-oil, over the 24-year period, 1975 through 1998. As we saw in the previous slide that I showed, roughly 30% depended on oil in 1975. Then, really as a consequence of the bounty of the North Slope, lots of oil, high prices, we became a very rich state and very dependent on oil revenue. For many years, we were over 80% dependent on revenue from the oil and gas industry. Recently, the proportion has fallen below 80%. That's not because we've begun to receive lots of revenue from other sources. The amount of revenue that we're receiving from sources other than the oil and gas industry is pretty close to $500 million a year, and it's remained pretty constant at that level for the last decade. So the change in proportion really reflects the drop in oil revenue and consequently the drop in the proportion because the non-oil revenue has remained relatively stable. Now, how about what has occasioned the drop in oil revenue? Obviously, the news media have focused on the low prices, and the low prices have definitely amplified the problem that we face. But at the root of the problem, no matter how you look at it, no matter what prices are, is this picture here. North Slope production in 1988 was a little over 2 million barrels a day. And we derived the revenue consequent to that production. Today, North Slope production has dropped below 1.2 million barrels a day. That's a 40% drop in oil production. And it's going to be roughly a 40% drop in oil revenue at whatever price oil revenues happen to be. And so faced with this decline, which has begun in 1988, is going to continue certainly after 2000. We have forecast a small bump up after 2000, but following 2003, we believe it's likely that the decline will continue unless there are some new major discoveries made on the North Slope, or unless oil prices went very high so that it was economic to develop some of the known resources that are there, but which are uneconomic to develop today. So that is the part of the story that doesn't get talked about a lot, but which is really drives the underlying long-term structural difficulty that we've got to deal with. We become very dependent on oil revenue, and oil production has dropped almost in half over the decade from 1988 to today. Of course, prices are what's in the news, and they're low today. This shows actual average annual destination prices for North Slope crude over the period from 1986 up to 1998, and then our forecast price levels for 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003, and over time, the price since the oil price crash that occurred at the end of 1985 and the beginning of 1986 have averaged about $16.50 per barrel at the destinations where Alaska North Slope crude is delivered to refineries for refining and marketing. Today, that price, as most of you know, is hovering right around $10 a barrel. We're forecasting that for this fiscal year, the average price will be in the mid-11s. We expect the price recovery over the next few years. We believe that the price will go up slightly in fiscal year 2000 to $12.50 a barrel, and then move back up into the low 16s in the years following out through fiscal year 2003, but we do not know that that will happen, and no one else knows either. And clearly, the very low prices that we're looking at there have captured everyone's attention, and certainly made it more urgent that we do something. But the need to do something underlie the situation that we face no matter what the price, because of the decline in production. Clearly, the low prices that we experienced last fiscal year, that we're experiencing this fiscal year, and that we forecast that we're going to experience next fiscal year, move the time up when we are going to be faced with the necessity to stop doing things the way we're doing them today. But the need to stop doing what we're doing today sometime was always there, and the price has simply moved the cliff a couple of years closer than it was. Just a this is just a table that compares total state general fund revenue for fiscal years 1998 and 1999. And I've broken out oil revenue up on the top of the chart there. Just to review what our oil revenues are, we get a portion of the 20 mil property tax that's imposed on the oil industry statewide. We levy a corporate income tax on the oil and gas industry, and that corporate income tax is modified. It's not quite the same structure as the corporate income tax that applies to other businesses in the state. We have a severance tax. We receive revenue from royalties because all of the North Slope production and almost all the Cook Inlet production is production from state-owned land. So that's revenue we receive as a consequence of being a landowner. Bonuses and rentals are also revenue that we receive as a consequence of being a landowner. Down below are the non-oil revenue that the state received in 1998 and what we project will receive in fiscal year 1999, between $450 and $500 million. The series of taxes and then a chunk of non-tax revenue at the bottom. And as you can see, total revenue for fiscal year 1998 was $1.827 billion, and projected for 99 is almost $1.3 billion. And so that's where we are today in terms of the amount of unrestricted general fund revenue that we have coming into the state treasury. On the expenditure side, this is what the general fund budget picture has looked like over the a little more than the last decade. As you can see, when you got to FY 92 and 93, the unrestricted general fund budget pushed $3 billion. It has declined since then. It's about, it's a little over midway between the $2 billion and the $2 billion 5 level today. And so that's what we're looking at in the way of expenditures out of our general fund. Now, again, let's just go back and look at, I mean, we're here today, FY 99, 2.3 something billion, and we look at our unrestricted revenue, and it's not quite 1.3 billion. And so the difference that we're looking at today is obviously $1 billion plus in this fiscal year's budget. Now, the deficit this year is larger than it's been over the last few years. But we've been, with the same structural problem has been with us most of this decade. We have been spending over the last 6 years, on average, between $400 and $500 million a year more than we had coming in the way of general fund revenue. And why didn't our warrants bounce? Well, our warrants didn't bounce because we were able to turn to a savings account that we had created in 1990, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. The Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund is a constitutionally created fund into which the proceeds from the settlement of disputes about taxes and royalties pertaining to the mineral industries, principally the oil and gas industry, but mineral industries in the state must be deposited. And during the 1990s, after the fund was created in 1990, we deposited almost $5 billion in settlement revenue. And the settlement elements are broken down on the chart that I've put up on the screen there. The severance tax or production tax, about $2.1 billion settlements that we received. The corporate income tax that's currently applicable, which some of you are quite familiar with, goes by the name modified apportionment. Corporate income tax is 1.1. We imposed the corporate income tax differently prior to 1982, called separate accounting. The settlement of the separate accounting disputes, $843 million. The royalty settlements that went into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund total $820. If you think for a moment, a quarter of the royalty settlements had to go into the permanent fund. None of the settlements of the tax matters must be deposited in the permanent fund. And then finally, about $1 million from the settlement of disputes pertaining to the 20 mil statewide property tax. So that's what's gone into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. I put up a table there that reflects the history and our projections on the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. Contributions began in fiscal year 1991, immediately after the constitutional amendment was adopted. The fund was invested. It earned income, and funds were not withdrawn from it in 1991 to balance the budget. Similarly, in 1992, another set of settlements, some more income, a balance at the end of the year of $563 million, no monies withdrawn to balance the general fund budget. Beginning in 93, however, we began to draw on the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund to balance the budget, and as you go down the next 6 years there, you can see the amounts that were withdrawn on a cash flow basis in each fiscal year up through fiscal year 1998, and you can see that we got to the end of fiscal year 1998, looking over on the far right-hand column, with between $3.5 and $3.6 billion invested in our Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. Now as we move forward, that's where we started the fiscal year, and today, as a consequence of the withdrawals that we've had to make so far this year, that balance is just a little under $3 billion. It's and a little over 2.9, but that's where the fund balance sits today. As we look forward, there are going to be some more disputes which will be settled and which will require deposits into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, and our projection of those over the next five fiscal years is a little over $100 million a year. The amount we will deposit in that this year will not reach that figure, I am sure, but I think that over the next 5 years, that's a pretty good average. Beyond FY 2003, it's our current belief that figure will fall to a relatively small amount, considerably smaller than the $106 million a year that you see reflected on that chart. So, going over to the net loans to general fund column, based on our current oil projections in terms of price and volume, we see a draw on the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund of $1.1 billion for this year, almost $1.1 billion for fiscal year 2000, and then in the high 800s for the next 3 years. And if that is what happens in terms of if the revenue figures that we talked about earlier that are flow from the price forecast and the volume forecast that we made, are pretty close to correct, then we're going to exhaust the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund sometime in early fiscal year 2003. This does not reflect when the fund would be exhausted, but it does show you, again, the projection of revenue against expenditure and show what the spending gap is graphically rather than as a line of numbers. But the message is the same.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, could we get a copy of all of these slides in the order that you're giving them, I think, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel when we're trying to discuss these issues. I think it'd be very
delighted to provide them to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, you know, I've shown this table to a bunch of people, and some people tell me it's too busy and it doesn't really, it's too hard to understand, and others say, great, this is just what I need to get my mind around where we are and where we're going. But I'll explain it. I mean, what I've done there is tried to look at when will we exhaust the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund at a range of oil prices and at a range of budget levels. So if we flatline the budget, and if we're right on our forecast about oil prices and volumes, then we're going to run out of our Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund in February 2003. If oil prices stay where they are today at $10.50 a barrel, and if we were to decide to increase the budget at 2% a year, we exhaust our Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund in December 2001. If we, if our budget levels are set at the level that was pertain to the plan that the legislative majority has been following for the last 3 years, if there's a $40 million cut this year and a $30 million cut next year, and oil stays at $10.50 a barrel, then we'll exhaust the Constitutional Budget Reserve in April 2002. So changing the budget that much gets you 4 months. And I've broken this down 1150, 1250, 1350, 1450, our forecast, which happens to on average typically knows. And if we average $16.50 a barrel this year and the following years, then we get out to May 2004. So, that is the problem that we're faced with. It is a problem that has been, it's a structural problem in our public finances that exists because we became so dependent on oil revenue. Oil production is dropping, and it's been traced through the thinking that you know, reflects how the governor decided on the package of proposals that are presented in the three bills. What were the considerations, the judgments that are reflected in the proposals that he's made and lie behind the legislation that we're here talking about this morning. First of all, let's talk about some principles, which some of which I think all of you will subscribe to, and a couple which some of you may not. But the first principle that we ought to focus on here is, you know, can we balance the budget on a sustainable basis? And if we can do that, shouldn't we do that? If we're going to balance the budget in part by reducing it, then those budget reductions must be responsible. And I don't think anybody can argue with that. Obviously, there are two elements to that. One is, you know, what kind of services ought you and must you provide to Alaska's citizens? The full range from government-provided infrastructure to a social safety net. Those are all the things that we, first of all, have to think about in terms of who's going to be affected. And secondly, there's another consideration, and that is the health of the Alaska economy. Whether wisely or unwisely, people will debate this, but government plays a big role in the Alaska economy. And when we're faced with a situation where other big sectors of the economy are reducing their own presence in the economy, what should the government do if it has some options in what it does in terms of its level of expenditure in an economy where this is, I mean, folks sometimes compare us to Alberta, where the government restructured its budget, but Alberta economy is a very different economy from Alaska, and it's not as if there are lots of people waiting to employ Alaska's public sector workers if they're suddenly put out on the job market. And so that's something we have to think about. Budget reductions must be responsible, and the responsibility of public officials goes both to public services and to the place of government in the economy. Third principle, maintain a healthy permanent fund dividend. That's something that was important to the governor in crafting the proposal that he's made. We'll go into that a little bit more, but that principle is something that was important to him in developing this package, and it's certainly important to many of you, and it may be important to all of you. The fourth principle, grow the state savings accounts. The objective there is not, if at all possible, to end up continuing on a path where we're simply spending savings to make ends meet. If we're going to need new taxes, the governor believed that any new tax should be fair and broad-based. And obviously, the question of fairness is one which folks differ on. We have the question of both. In any broad-based tax, you have the questions of horizontal equity. You're comparing yourself to your neighbor. If you think they're in more or less the same economic circumstances, you are, and you have the question of vertical equity, and that is how progressive do you think a tax system ought to be in terms of looking at the ability of people to pay. And so those are considerations which, if there is considerable legislative debate about broad-based taxes, you'll hear a lot about, I'm sure. And finally, an important principle to the governor is no change to the permanent fund or the dividend program without a vote of the people. And that's a pledge he made to Alaska voters in seeking the office of the governor. That is a pledge which he intends to keep. Now, working from those principles and a $1 billion plus deficit today, likely $800 million deficits on out into the future, what's available? And what are the considerations that pertain to the tools that are available? Well, all of us want to continue to get as big a permanent fund dividend as we possibly can when we're being as human as we all are, and none of us want to pay taxes that we don't have to. None of us enjoy writing those checks, having the money withheld from our paycheck, and so on. And so all of us would say, well, gee, if you could cut expenditures and solve the problem, shouldn't you do that? focusing, of course, on what it is you're spending money on and the need for those expenditures. So, you know, if you think about budget cuts, here we have, and I put the capital budget up, but I put the general fund operating budget up, and you know, it's a little over $2.2 billion. And we have a $1 billion problem. And so what could we do to cut and get the money that we need to make ends meet? And what you see here is a slide that breaks the general fund operating budget down into pieces that are, I think, a little easier to use in getting your mind around the budget. Core state government, you know, the legislature, courts, executive branch agencies, people in state office buildings around the state, what people normally think of as state government, spends in the FY99 general fund operating budget, going to spend about $780 million. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Local schools. We've made a policy choice here decades ago to fund the majority of local schools out of our state treasury. There's a broad range of decisions that states have made around the country. Some largely fund them from local taxes. Most states contribute a significant portion of local school budgets out of the state treasury. Alaska has chosen to pay for elementary and secondary education out of the state treasury at a percentage basis that's at the top end of the choices that states have made for funding schools. And the reasons for that are many. Many schools around the state simply don't have a tax base available to them that they could call on, and some do, and the choice we've made is to heavily pay for a significant proportion of state schools out of the state budget. We have provided over the years assistance to local government that has shrunk enormously from what it was a decade ago, but we still do have revenue sharing and municipal assistance that does go to local governments. We provide a significant part of the university's budget out of the general fund, $172 million in FY99. We choose nonprofits to provide services in a number of locations around the state. Health services is an area where we, in particular, have chosen to do that. So you really need to take the $110 million grants to nonprofits and independent agencies and think of that together with core state government, because that's a decision to provide services to people through a private nonprofit organization rather than government employees. And then over here, formula programs, those are the social safety net and longevity bonus kinds of programs. You've got the adult public assistance, the ATAP program, Medicaid, and the longevity bonus program in that formula program category. Now, as you look at that and say $1 billion, and if you took a billion, if you shut down the legislature and decided that you're going to fire your staff and not pay yourselves and you're going to send me home, shut down the court system across the street and so on, but get rid of the nonprofit agency programs that we had, but continue your social safety net, local school, university system, we still wouldn't have enough to close the gap.
Is not, you know, I keep hearing that argument, you know, if we shut down, if we laid off all the state workers, we still wouldn't have enough to close the gap. But the general operating budget there reflects $2.2 billion, but the actual spending is $6.2 billion, considering the off-budget items, federal pass-throughs, and total state spending as a whole is about $6.2 billion. And so I guess the big question that I think everybody wants to know is, where is the rest of that money going? I mean, is it programs that we're spending all that money on? I think I know the answer to the question, but, you know, I just have a hard time with the argument, well, we just lay off all the state workers, we're still $1 billion short. Or won't close the budget gap. I mean, what's happened to the other $5 billion?
Well, let's talk about that, if we might, for a moment. And it's very, that's one of the things I think is going to be very important in the discussions that proceed here, is that everybody has to, that cares about this, needs to be assured that the numbers aren't cooked in some way. Now, when you talk about the $6 billion budget, you talk about the dividend that's included in that. You talk about the inflation proofing, which is the appropriation back out of the earnings reserve to the permanent fund.
Could you put some figures on some of those, Will?
Well, the dividend is $900 million. Inflation proofing is on the order of $300 million at today's inflation rate. And when you net out those kinds of expenditures and just talk about the operating budget, I think the number comes back to a little over $4 billion, it's $2.2-$2.3 of general fund. There's a billion roughly of federal money that goes through, and then there's another billion of dollars show up in the appropriation bill that are the off-budget part of this that we're talking about. And when you break that down, there are about $200 million of that is money which is already been appropriated to an agency and then is sent to another agency, and the legislature wants to control that, as they should. I mean, our department gets got an appropriation from the legislature of between $14 and $15 million to run our child support enforcement program. That program requires a heavy use of lawyers, for obvious reasons, and so we use about $1 million worth of legal services to run the child support enforcement program. And so the Department of Law's budget reflects the $1 million that goes from us to the Department of Law to run the child support enforcement program. So $15 million is appropriated to us, and then of that 15, another million is appropriated over to the Department of Law. And that activity throughout state government, whether you're talking about the provision by the Department of Law of legal services, the way we handle the use of data processing in our budget and so on, the billing of Department of Transportation personnel to individual capital projects and so on, when you add all of that up, it's about $200 million of the $1 billion. And then we have all of the independent corporations and the money that they spend, the Permanent Fund, the Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, the Municipal Bond Bank, Student Loan Corporation. Did I mention Housing Finance? And all of those entities, again, the legislature controls their budget. They all all of the organizations that I mentioned generate revenue, and the revenue that they generate is intended to run those programs. That is not revenue which, in the main, is available. If you try to get that revenue and use it on the general fund budget for my department, those entities as quasi-business entities will simply disappear, and the money won't be there anymore. And all of that is money that is important for the legislature to control the expenditure of, because they're the policymaker, and the way they can exercise that policy is through the appropriation process. But when you talk about the money that's there, that's hidden, that might be spent, looking at it from a revenue forecasting perspective, you know, I'm supposed to go out and tell you how much general fund revenue you have, and going through all of that, for FY98 come up with $110, $120 million that we might quarrel about. We didn't include it in the general fund revenue forecast. It's being used for a dedicated purpose, and it's something that you might argue with me about. And I think it's very important as we move forward in the discussions that, you know, if I'm off the wall in terms of that number, that the right number be on the table, because if people do think there's $6 billion out there to spend and what's the problem, then we're not going to address the problem, which I'm here today testifying is a real problem. And I believe that maybe it's $100 million smaller than what I've testified to, but it is not $1 billion smaller, and you got a $1 billion problem, and maybe it's $900 million.
Thank you for that. You know, I just have to insert here, Mr. Condon, if I might, because the whole budget process is so complicated, you know, that when things are going fine, nobody cares. It just happens and goes on. So I think this whole exercise is extremely important, not only for the legislature, but for the other members of the administration and the public in general. But there's one, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, and if you don't, maybe you can get it for me, but one of the things, and if the state spending is $6 billion, and then there's, of course, other federal spending, there's the military, and then there's the private sector's money that's spent. Do you have an idea what the top amount of money is in the state that fuels our economy? Do you know what that is?
What portion
that $6 million is of that?
They say about $15 billion in total in the state.
So then is it including the $6 billion?
Yes.
Okay, so then that means we are providing 6/15ths of it?
Well, I don't have those figures immediately in hand, but I will get those.
Okay. I'd be interested to know that, because I think that is relevant to the issue. If this money were to go away, there'd be a huge hole.
Yes. There would be a huge hole. I mean, and anything that one does, I mean, all of the options that are available take some money out of the Alaska economy somewhere. You just can't, much as we'd love to have something for nothing, it's not possible. If we impose an income tax, it takes some money out of the economy. If we lower the size of the permanent fund dividend, it takes the money out of the economy. If we cut the government budget, it takes that money out of the economy. And so you're right, and I'll certainly get some.
Representative Cogdill and then Representative Wilkins.
Thank you for answering the questions. With regard to the core state government and the issue you brought about dedicated funds that are going to be off budget, the employment that is in the state, is the retirement funds, are they dedicated funds, or are they within that figure of the core government there?
The retirement funds are dedicated funds. Depending on what the contribution to, that's taken out of your paycheck and mine, and the state match for that, is reflected in the core state government, the ongoing contributions. But the people who have retired and are receiving a retirement check is not reflected in the core state government, nor are the monies that are used to pay the management fees for managing the money that's in the retirement portfolio, or the administrative expenses for the Division of Retirement and Benefits and Department of Administration, which services all of the people who were in the public employees, teachers, judicial, and military retirement systems.
That kind of helps a little bit. And then is it also in that number of core state government under the general operating funds, the benefits paid to employees, is that also within that number, or is that off budget as well?
The benefits that are paid to state employees other than the retirement benefits that they ultimately will receive as part of the core state government.
I wanted to know what's out of the line there.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, Representative Ogden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. I'd like to make a point also that if you take money out of the economy by tax, that also is takes it out of the economy, or the private sector economy, puts it into the government economy, of course, which helps Juneau a lot. But that essentially, if we can get back to the original point I made, $6 billion, take $2 billion of that, $2 billion of that off the table because it's a permanent fund. We have a budget of about $4 billion with the federal pass-throughs, and that you're correct that we can't close the budget gap by laying off every employee in the state. But if we eliminate some programs, I think we can go a long way to closing that budget gap. And because it's not just the employees' cost, it's the cost. That's just the cost of managing the program. But we do so many programs that no other state does in the nation. Because frankly, I think we're the most socialist state in the nation. And if we eliminate some of those programs, then maybe we could seriously reduce the budget, not just eliminate state employees.
Well,
that's a judgment call.
If I might, let's try to keep our comments as questions and not debate. I don't want to get into any debate here. Okay. I'd like to just...
Well, I guess that was a question, but I mean...
Yeah, okay. If you have a question, that's fine, but I don't want to be in this portion of this get into debate.
Of course you can close part of the budget gap by cutting programs, but the numbers are enormous, and it's hard to see how you would get a significant proportion of $1 billion out of programs without eliminating a very large percentage of what it is state government does, and that's obviously the thing to wrestle with.
One more question here.
I agree with you on that point, but it is also true that if we were doing $4 billion, the math that I get here says that it would be $12,000 on the backs of each person in Alaska to make up that. So we're talking a pretty good chunk of change there, too. So you couldn't tax it out of the economy.
No.
So just there's the balance to that.
That's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the point here, though, is, thinking about budget cuts, how far can you go? And that's be responsible to the citizens of the state, responsible stewards of the Alaska economy. Now, let's talk a little bit about the permanent fund, and that is a place where you could turn as you think about it, potential tool that's available. This is a graphic that the permanent fund uses to demonstrate the relative importance of permanent fund income in comparison to the state's oil revenue. And as you can see, oil revenue dominated the state revenue in comparison to income from the permanent fund until 1998, and following 1998, we project that the income of the permanent fund will surpass oil revenue thereafter. Now, here's, I think, the way you ought to think about
the permanent fund, or a way to put the permanent fund in context in terms of the economics of it, forgetting the politics of it for a moment. Thinking of it as an endowment, which it is, whether it's an endowment that pays Alaska dividend, Alaskans dividends, or supports in part the provision of government services in Alaska, today it's worth $25 billion, its market value. And we have a somewhat complicated set of formulae in our statutes for figuring out what income is and then calculating the dividend amount, and I don't want to get off into that now. But as an endowment, how much could you take out of it every year for dividends and whatever else you wanted to take out, and still preserve the purchasing power of the fund? You know, setting the formulae that are in the statute aside for one moment. Well, you could probably preserve the purchasing power of the fund and take out 5% of the market value of the fund on an annual basis. As you look around the country at endowments, there are some universities which invest their money very much more aggressively than the permanent fund is invested, and they strive for a 5.25% payout a year as endowments. And you can look at a lot of other hospitals and universities and foundations and find that they're in the 4.25%, 4.5% range. So it's hard for me to believe that we would feel comfortable investing the money at a risk level that would generate more than 5% a year. And if you took 5% a year out and you were invested more or less like we are today, the fund would be inflation-proofed. And if you take 5% of $25 billion, that gives you $1.25 billion a year. If you thought 4% was all you could really get over the long term, and some of you might think that, then it'd be $1 billion a year. Now, if you turned to the permanent fund to close the budget gap, and you said we're going to leave public spending where it is today, maybe reduce it $100 million. But if you turn to the permanent fund for $800 million a year to pay government expenses, then you would cut the dividend program at least in half in terms of what the dividend looks like today. The dividend payment to Alaskans was almost $900 million this last year. So in terms of thinking about what's there, and you know, you can write all kinds of formulae that would get you there, but thinking about the permanent fund as an asset that you want to preserve the purchasing power of, if you want to have a dividend program that looks more or less like the dividend program we have today, then there's only going to be $400 or $500 million at the most in the immediate future that would be available to still preserve a dividend program at about the level we see today. So,
if I might, on that question, I don't know what the number is, but the amount that, by statutory amount that we put into the permanent fund from the oil revenues, how much would that be?
Well, it's about $100 million a year at today's oil prices that goes into the principal of the fund as a consequence of the dedication.
Madam Chair, question on the graph.
Rogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Condon, notice that your graph shows for the last 20 years quite a few spikes up, and generally I would say more on the upside rather than the downside, but I think maybe for the next 20 years it shows rather a pessimistic view that we're not going to have any more upsides on in price, and are those factored in to the future there because of the drop in production? Or I mean, it's just, you know, on one side, then it's like on the downside, in the future. I guess is that somewhat politically motivated or just?
No.
It's an honest professional judgment about what we think oil prices are and oil production volumes are going to be. And we had $40 oil. And maybe we'll have $40 oil again, but if we get $40 oil again, it's going to be at a production level that's very much lower than the production level we had when we saw $40 oil before. This graphic, I borrowed from the Permanent Fund. They put it together to brag about the importance of the Permanent Fund in Alaska's economy. And I didn't want to make another graphic.
Thank you.
Well, the fact that you can't, if you're going to preserve a dividend program, you simply can't solve the fiscal gap problem with the permanent fund. You could solve the fiscal gap problem if you wanted to eliminate the dividend, but if you wanted to preserve the dividend, and that's something which the governor believes is important, then what do you do? If you can't get there with budget cuts, and it doesn't look to him like you could get there with a combination of budget cuts and turning to the permanent fund, then you have to find some way to raise public revenue, and he believes that we ought to do that through some kind of a broad-based tax. And just to talk a little bit about taxes, which are never going to be popular, but we need to talk about them. Let's look at Alaska's tax program compared to the average states, or an average of all the states across the country tax program. And what you see up there is our 1998 tax revenues, which for oil and gas, except the oil and gas corporate income tax, constitute almost 60% of our tax revenues. And if you add in the oil and gas portion of the corporate income tax, it takes it over 70. So our taxes rest heavily on the oil and gas industry, and we do get some property tax revenue. We do have the excise taxes. We do have corporate income, both oil and gas and non-oil and gas. We do have some other small taxes, but we have no sales tax statewide, and we have no individual income tax statewide. And when you look at the experience in other states, you can see that on average, tax revenue, a third of the tax revenue of the other states comes from each of sales and income. And so in thinking about Alaska and how Alaska stacks up against other states, that's certainly one perspective on taxes. And obviously, when we're talking about taxes, we're focused here on two different broad-based taxes. This next slide is really the same information with some more added in, and that is looking at the entire public revenue picture for Alaska compared to other states, adding in the non-tax revenue that we have, including federal revenue. You can see Alaska contrasted with the national average. And when you put all the revenue together, you can see that other states turn to these broad-based taxes from a total revenue perspective for about a little under 20% of their revenue. And of course, we do not do that in Alaska, and that is another way of thinking about what we're doing in comparison to other states. Just to take a couple of different slices at the tax issue by comparing us to other states, what I've put up there are a list of the states that have no state sales tax. There are five. And a list of the states that have no individual income tax, and there are seven. In addition to the seven listed there, the states of Tennessee and New Hampshire have an individual income tax that's only imposed on interest and dividends and not on wages and salaries. So they're tiny income taxes. The rest of the states that impose them are generally applicable to wages and salaries as well as investment income. Alaska is the only state that has neither a statewide sales tax nor a statewide individual income tax. I've depicted that here on a map slide, which many of you have seen me show before. And that simply shows you who doesn't have a personal income tax and who doesn't have a sales tax, and then Alaska with neither.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative
Thank you, Commissioner Condon. I was looking through my packet on the income tax issue, and I don't see a chart as to how much each individual would pay based on the amount that they make and their dependents and those kind of things. Is that?
That's something we can provide you.
I'd like to see that. Possible. Thank you.
That's something we can provide you. And of course, you know, another perspective on the income tax, or an income tax. It doesn't have any income tax structure that raised $350 million. And then taking that tax and asking, well, on a per capita basis, just dividing the revenue by the total population, what kind of a per capita tax load would Alaskans be carrying relative to people, and that's a state income tax load, relative to people in other states. And we talked about New Hampshire and Tennessee down at the bottom with only taxes imposed on interest and dividends, and then a full statewide tax, North Dakota, $255 per capita. Alaska would be $571. And it puts it right in the middle of states. That doesn't say that that's what you ought to do, but it's just to put it in at least some kind of a perspective.
Thank
you, Madam Chairman. I have a concern with that particular slide, and that is that you utilized a per capita cost. And yet, to the best of my ability to discern, this will not be a per capita tax. In other words, there will be a significant portion of the population that is excluded. And perhaps I'm getting ahead of myself, but and I hope you do have a slide that will indicate that those who are actually paying the tax, what they will be paying. And I think that's the true number as opposed to the per capita notion. I would merely make that as a comment and hope that that information would be forthcoming.
Yes, the whole question of who pays relative to who doesn't pay is an important question. I do not have any more slides to show you this morning, but obviously as we continue our discussions, I'm going to need some to show. And the question of what is the fairest broad-based tax is something which the governors obviously put a proposal on the table. It is a proposal which, when you look at it, you'll conclude is very progressive in terms of its pays, and the question of what is the fairest way to raise tax revenue on a broad base is something which the governor invites your views on. And I'm sure that I need to give you more information.
Well, we'll be back here Saturday, and and you can be prepared for more questions. It's 20 minutes to 10 now, and I have a few people on teleconference, and I also have some people who have called in and want me to read their testimony into the record. So if you just sit right there, and so I can get this done, and we still have a little bit more time, we'll ask you some more questions.
Okay.
I think, first of all, we'll go to Anchorage. We have Don Ruling.
Yes, I'm here, Madam Chair.
Would you like to give us your testimony?
I have a couple points that I'd like to make. One of the points is that is written regarding the federal or the state withholding on crew members or crew shares.
Yes, okay.
And I'm a CPA here representing myself, if you need a representation. And what I'm concerned about is most of my fishermen clients are required right now by federal law to issue a 1099 reporting form for earnings of $600 or more per fisherman. And for them to step back and make this now on all earnings from every crew member, whether it be $20 or over $600, is going to be very difficult for many of these people because they have a hard enough time doing the 1099s, which are done annually instead of on a monthly or weekly basis, depending on when the crew shares are paid. And what I mean here is when you're withholding the state tax on each of these members. And one of my other concerns is how are we going to train these fishermen to do this, which is going to be, I think, a very large cost to the state, and how are we going to tell them what areas of their fishing, you know, when they're fishing out in the ocean, when they reach a 3-mile limit, whether or not they are going to be required to do any kind of reporting to show that they were over that limit and therefore not required to withhold on those crew shares during that time period. Secondly, what I was going to talk about was the filing of these tax returns. I think how much time has been spent on looking at the forms and so on, because they've talked about postcard size, at least what newspapers said, and think that there's quite a bit of computations going to be required to come up with the state income tax portion based on the federal filing, because we have family rules where you have to do a combination of all family members of their income tax after federal credits, and then after state credits, you come up with a state income tax liability due. So we need to look at this a little closer than just say it's a postcard size, so everybody has, if it's not going to require much accounting. I think one of the things it's going to require is, for my profession, we're going to have to do more work, which we're not complaining about, but I think it's important to understand that it's just not a state income tax. It's going to be a tax of each of the individuals to pay their CPA or tax preparer to prepare these. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Letourneau in Anchorage?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I had four comments which were exceedingly technical, and I will not bore you with those comments because after listening to the presentation, I now understand that the adoption of the tax in total is very much a question you're still debating. However, if you do ultimately decide to adopt a tax, I would suggest as a tax preparer that the tax in this specific statutory language be tied more directly to the Internal Revenue Code than it currently is. In the language of the bill that has been proposed, there is a reference to federal income tax, which in my understanding is not a defined term under the Internal Revenue Code, and I would suggest a